Dinky Dawson, and Tony Rain, and we're kicking off our podcast, Two Pints in a Corner.
Yeah, Two Pints in a Corner. Remember, we used to sit down and have a pint and chat about the old times. So.
Sure, well, we didn't, but we used to watch old geezers doing that.
Oh, yeah. That is true.
Yeah. And you know, bear with us. We'll try to speak slowly because we know a lot of you don't understand what we're saying.
Hey, up. Hey, up. Why they are doing, eh?
We don't. We unfortunately are not members of the Received Pronunciation Group, which is the Queen's English, or I guess the King's English now. But we are both Brits, and we've both been in America for a long time. And we have a somewhat interesting, we think, past at the Channel Club in Boston. We know a lot's been said about the Channel in recent years. There has been a podcast, which I think highlighted the darker stories of the club and the demise of the club, which was sad for both of us.
Oh yeah.
But we want to accentuate the positive and talk about the music and the good times. And this came about when Dinky and I were having a pint or a cup of tea or something somewhere and just started shooting the breeze and said, you know, somebody might be interested in this.
I would say so. You know, I mean, there's so many acts that came through, so much fun that we had in that with many people, so much fun before we even got there. I mean, I came in 1 year in 1982 to see a group called State of Mind, the local group from South Shore, and I enjoyed the place because it was a scene happening in there. A lot of people having fun regardless of that band on stage. Even when we were in there, they were having great fun. It got crazy later on because of the accent of different kinds of music that came through. When you look at it, a lot of 60s, a lot of even 50s legends came through that place. And we had fun working with them. I'd already worked with a bunch of them on the road in my times in the 60s. And I know you had in certain things too, Tony, with Eaton and what have you.
Yeah, you'd been in the business. You were in there from the 60s in England, right?
Oh, yeah. So 65 I started.
Wow. I was 10.
But it was, you know, we loved going to the clubs, Tony. That was the bottom line. We enjoy ourselves when we go into them, you know, nightclubs, but they were all for teens.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day. I was reading something on venues, and I think an interesting point that the Channel was cool for us, and some of the venues I've worked since were cool, was that the venues were kind of raw and not defined. Those clubs were, and you started in Stringfellows in Sheffield, which was the Mojo Club, the Mod Club, and a dance club. But for me and the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of our first concerts were just in raw venues, public halls.
Public halls, yeah.
You know, even the Roundhouse in London had been a train turntable, right? But they were raw space. And I think what always fascinated me was the way that the venue would change from show to show and crowd to crowd. So it meant something different to every audience. Everybody. It had a different vibe. And I always got that out of the Channel. I always thought it was cool that we would see all of it.
I agree.
Changing from above, and those people would come in and the audience would come in get their own take on the place, whether it was a metal night or an oldies night or a reggae night. It meant different things to different people. But it was kind of cool to sit there and watch it change every day. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it changed two or three times in a day. We'd have a show in the afternoon.
Yeah.
With metals or something, and then at night with reggae.
Oh, yeah. World music. I remember in 1986, which was the hard year, we worked there hard. We were doing hardcore shows on Sunday afternoons the Circle Jerks and the Dead Kennedys and... Who else? Who was the guys that you used to like?
Well, 86 were in respect of looking at some of the 50s and 60s acts that played. And RBQ played there a lot.
A lot, yeah.
A lot with them horns and stuff. Oh, my goodness. That was fun. James Brown, he played there twice.
Yep.
You know?
And yeah, it was fascinating.
And Greg Allman played there a bunch of times. So you got some of the big ones. Jerry Lee Lewis played there twice. Yep. And it was good to see the old stuff coming because that's what I work with.
the mix was always good. I remember the band coming in, you know.
Oh, the band a bunch of times. With
Levon Helms and Danko and I remember they wouldn't come in the club. They ate their dinner in the back of the limo from the Chinese restaurant.
they just
came in and hit the stage and then left. Yeah.
That was the thing. All you people that's out there that remember the channel, just round the corner was Waylo's.
Waylo's.
And we used to go there because it was not only convenient, it was really good.
It was Waylo's of pizza.
And then yeah, Waylo's of pizza. And then my daughter, she was doing the delis for a while in the late 80s with the, you know, for the delis for all the stuff. And we used to get old Jackie, he'd come in there and start it, he'd go to walk into the the cooler and find the deli, and you could see there's a little hole here and there where he took some ham.
Pulling rolled ham off it and stuff, yeah. Living on that.
That's for the stompers, leave them alone.
Well, it was a wonder he gave me anything, because I remember when we were first in there, they would never...
No. Yeah,
I don't think we ever gave him anything that was on the riders. It was
totally
dirty towels and tap water.
Oh. and the ice in the bucket in the sink
in the back room.
Oh, that was funny.
Yeah, it was brutal.
Oh yeah, but it was funky club. It was great for that. The scene was so good. In fact, when I first came in, I'd heard about the few years before was Spinal Tap. They came in and they played and they're having a great old time, and all of a sudden the damn false roof above them came down on top of them.
I remember it had a drop ceiling, didn't it, back then?
That drop ceiling had got full of water from the rain above. It had gone through the roof.
Yeah.
Costa, who used to clean the place, and his daughter,
yeah,
they would be in there all the time trying to fix that roof, trying to do this. So after I got in there, I says, this is it. Let's close for a day. After I've been in there a while, let's close for a day and we'll just take that whole roof down. And it became a really open venue.
Yeah, I remember.
Metal at that point, because it was metal roof.
I remember standing up on the stage with you at the monitor board one night at a sold out reggae show. And that ceiling was so low, the smoke was hanging so thick. And we were both high as kites on the second-hand smoke in there. It was unbelievable.
Oh, that's the bar ride. It was fun.
You see, we that smoke was always Kevin. Bad, yeah.
Kevin may come down and have a chat with us.
Yeah, that's Kevin Elmer, right? Yeah, he was the
Black Star Line.
He was the house reggae DJ and world beat guy.
Black Star Line. And also, we've heard that Sean's going to come down, Sean McNally, and talk about the metal, but also cringe stuff.
Yeah, that's Sean came out of there. He was head of security
for years.
Quite a bit of time, yeah.
He went through a lot of stuff with a lot of major artists as well as what he liked with
all the groups. We'll bring some of those guys in to join us.
Yeah,
that's
what we're going to do, and do that.
We've got a friend of ours coming in as we get rolling here, Tim Miller, who's a journalist and entertainment critic who we've known for years, and he wants to come in and just prompt us with some questions and see what he can get. So we're looking forward to
certain places.
Looking forward to seeing Tim. He's a music guy too, and a film guy. And there is a lot of interest in the club still. It's come back around. We should say how we kind of arrived at it, and Dinky, how much work Dinky did. With the onslaught of the internet, we bought the address bostonsbestliverock.com, thinking that at some point there would be some nostalgia going on. And gave it to Dinky to work with, and Dinky, fortunately, back in the early 2000s, preserved the artwork from the channel, the logo, which had never been registered. And also spent a lot of time with Brad Mindich at the Phoenix newspaper, combing through the archives of all the advertising to compile a very, very extensive list of everybody who played the club from 1980 until it folded in 1992. Yeah. So if you go to Boston's Best Live Rock
Com.
You can scroll through there by year, and he's got everybody in there, all the local bands.
Yeah.
See your name up there. If you just look in.
Some of the local bands have already asked me to post a bunch of their videos that they made after that.
If you can't remember the night you got that first date or a pickup in the club and who was playing, you can go have a look, and you might remember the concert, and it'll jog your memory.
There's some good concerts to remember too.
Oh, there were some big nights.
Sometimes it was 7 days a week. That was every night was a good concert.
Yeah, I know. And I came into the club in early 1985 as a bartender. I was just looking for extra money. I was working in the restaurant business out in Burlington, and started picking up one night a week and training. And they kind of picked up on me as management training. So I ended up making a deal with them that I would finish my training course at the restaurant. And then when I was done, I would come in as sort of the operations manager, overseeing the bars and the scheduling and things like that. So I'd got in there in 85, and it was clear that things were ready for a change. It had been in business since 80. Doing a lot of local bands and some nationals, quite a
good
extensive
bands.
List of good national stuff, but spotty. But by 85, 86, the business was getting more competitive. Clubs like the Ritz in New York, the 930 in DC, were creating what was becoming a circuit for national touring bands, was starting to fall into place. And the Channel had been capitalizing on that, and it was good. It was exciting. It was a different club. And it had a good vibe to it when I was bartending there. So I jumped in, and they asked what they thought needed changing, and they told me they were looking to upgrade the sound system at the time, and they'd been talking to another English guy, Dinky Dawson, and did I know him? And of course I didn't. I didn't know much about the Boston music business at the time, but Dinky and I met, and we had a great time in there for probably one of the best years the club had, I think.
Yeah, that was 86 when I
86
came.
You came in, and we tried
March 3rd, exactly.
We tried to upgrade the production and make it something that, you know, something special, and ended up working a lot.
Every day, just
about. Two shows on Sundays.
No.
Lunchtime sessions.
It was interesting. I mean, I came in, I had to bring in the large sound system that I took off the roads that I built in 1972, but also I brought in a console so that everybody could use it, a Yamaha, so it was a standard console to be able to be used. Because the stuff I built in 72, I built a high-end mixing console that nobody could really operate except me, because I didn't put any marks on it.
Right.
I just thought it was a black console with black knobs.
Yeah, I remember the monitor board was just like a stainless steel or aluminum, right? But no, with nothing on it.
Stainless steel with nothing.
Nothing on it, just a bunch of knobs. And you were trying to teach me how to run monitors with this thing. It was all in your head. You had to sort of count across the channels and figure it out.
The thing is that you had to use your hearing.
Yeah.
You didn't. Today, everybody uses either an iPad or something stupid that is to do with computers.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, people don't hear digital.
No.
They hear analog. And analog rules. I'm sorry. But that's why
I agree with you.
Every kind of band that played every kind of music that you could ever imagine. And the music progressed into different genres along. Like, I wanted to learn what this new stuff is called metal.
Metal music,
I mean, by 1982, there was nobody there. No metal. It became, the metal itself started on December 2nd, 1982, with this group formerly called Axis.
Mm-hmm. This was in the Channel,
In the Channel, and they changed their name to Mass.
The Mass. But yeah, metal came from, I mean, I'd been a hard rock fan.
Oh, yeah.
Zeppelin and Sabbath.
Sabbath.
And the stuff that was coming out, Uriah Heep, Wishbone Ash.
And most of the bands that were, that came through, were either a pop or hard.
But then metal was the harder edge.
But the metal changed everything.
Well, it was volume mainly,
society,
wasn't it?
Society, the volume for one.
And it was volume and getting bigger toys and making more noise. I mean, basically, I think even bands like Slade were big contributors, and Slade were the skinhead band.
Just remember in 84, Spinal Tap had to turn everything up to 11.
Up to 11. and Slade had done what? Come On, Feel the Noise.
Oh, that was later. But
yeah, well, way back in the 70s, they'd done that. Then they covered it. I remember the whole thing. And then where did we go from there?
I had Slade once.
Yeah.
They opened for me. They were just unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
It was all noise.
It was all noise. Well, they were the loudest band. I mean, I saw them in Blackburn in 73 or 74 when they first started, and people's ears were bleeding. They were taking people out to the ambulances.
Well, that's interesting, because in 1969, mm-hmm. there was this group called Blue Cheer.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, Fleetwood Mac played for Blue, played in Detroit in their hometown.
Right.
Blue Cheer. So this was supposed to be loud. Peter Green nodded to me off when I was mixing them. I was on off stage. He said, he nodded to me, and that meant me run up on the stage, plug every amplifier into his six-string bass and let it rip, and don't forget to turn it up in the PA.
Yeah.
So I did, and I knocked in this Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. I blew Blue Cheer off the
wow. place. Summertime Blues was there, remember? Hardcore version of Summertime Blues.
It was 10 dB less. Blah, 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 blah. And they couldn't believe it. Everybody was deaf from my six-string bass solo. I loved every minute of it. I said, who's a good, who's loud?
And that metal stuff just splintered again, didn't it?
Remember when we had in the channel, we had them groups, Manowar and stuff. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, so loud.
Biohazard, Wargasm, Pantera.
All that stuff. The thing is that the Manowar and those groups that were coming from Europe and stuff too, Damned and what have you, were loud.
I used to hide in the office going, make it stop.
It was too... See, now you're getting to know the nitty-gritty. Oh, my goodness, Tony, you hanging in the office.
I was waiting for Billy Bragg to come.
Well, yeah. No, I understand. There's so much variety that came through. When you get into 83, and just talking of metal, Black Flag, Angry Samoans, Flipper, Crucifix, The Holy Men.
I was getting into the hardcore stuff, and then the other ones were the hair bands, weren't they?
Oh, I love the hair bands, because you got Extreme.
Cinderella. And
all the hair bands.
The pretty boys.
Because all the girls that would come from... one area of Boston, particularly.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all look gorgeous because they're all in there. Right. These nice coats, nice thing. I mean, I remember seeing Gary Cherone on stage singing away, and this girl comes up and she's got a coat on, and she just opened it, and Gary nearly fell off the stage because she just got bra and panties on.
Oh, it was a fun night. That was the glamorous nights. I remember all those girls. They all drank Pearl Harbors.
That's it. Oh, they did, didn't they? Hey, but they enjoyed themselves, and we enjoyed looking.
Yeah, it was again, the changes of the place from night to night, I remember all those hair bands. I used to joke about the dressing room having stalagmites hanging from the ceiling from the hairspray.
Some of them were lighting fire with their hairspray.
It
was fun.
But it'd go from that to ridiculous Wendy O. Williams from the Plasmatics.
Oh, she was great.
The punk
great
show. And,
talk about great show.
And things like the Sisters of Mercy played in there from Leeds, dark and heavy, heavy stuff, It was all good stuff. Where did your sound system, that system that you brought in there, you'd had that on the road since the 70s?
72, first show that we ever did was out in Lennox with a group called Mahavishnu Orchestra.
You did John McLaughlin, yeah.
And then John couldn't believe it, so they wanted to take me on tour, so I went on tour with them later. But prior to that, in late 72, I had the Kinks.
You did a Kinks tour.
And then this group in San Antonio were opening for them. They opened for 3 days, this young band. Ray Davis was all upset. He didn't want anybody to do sound check, so they'd do their sound check until doors opened. So this band was all freaked out. And this is what used to happen in rock and roll. Was really freaked out. But I said to the kid, I have no idea who they are. I've never heard of them. And I didn't know what the music was. But I said to him, I said, oh, go get set up. and we'll get a line check, but we'll also do a little quick number, so I've got a mix on. And I thought that was cool. Well, come to find out, this band eventually hired me to do sound for them. Except by 74, I was doing a tour. The group was called Steely Dan.
That was how you got to Steely Dan, so, yeah.
And I did a bunch of albums in the studio with them and worked with them in doing that kind of stuff. But the bottom line is that the music was fantastic. The Kinks couldn't take that kind of stuff because they weren't involved with that. They were just into rock and roll.
Right. And you had one of my favorite bands on that tour, right? Lindisfarne.
Oh, Lindisfarne was
who
great.
Were my one of my all-time favorite groups growing up in England. I still listen to Lindisfarne.
But none of this stuff ever came to the channel. But then again, the stuff that I had worked on over the years, New Riders, Edgar Winter, Commander Cody. Oh, I love Commander Cody. Mm-hmm. He was great. I used to love them playing opening for the Birds. They were fantastic.
Yeah.
Junior Walker. Oh, my favorite. Junior Walker, Sam and Dave. Mike Love even came through, I noticed, doing the thing. Elvin Bishop.
Right.
And then the December 26, 1981, NRBQ
played a lot in there.
And then Commander Cody played there twice. Unbelievable. Barney Bramlett, Joe Cocker played there twice, Eric Burden, Robbie Krueger. And then I came in 1982 with a group called Mamas and Papas.
Right.
And that was on their sound, the older sound system. I enjoyed it. It wasn't fantastic, but they enjoyed it because it was a club that was different.
Right.
And they'd not really played much before that, except where I'd been helping. I helped them reform them, the guys.
Yeah, and they were on that sort of summer circuits by the knobs.
We live in a world of cell phones. And everybody wants to get hold of you when you start talking.
Yeah, I've got to take them. Sorry. But damn it, we'll have to edit this.
We'll always edit some.
It's voicemail, I'll get him after. That was supposed to be 4 o'clock this afternoon. That's all right. The Mamas and Papas stuff, was they were out. What were you doing with them?
Well, we
regularly
reformed them down in New York. My friend had called me up if we go down to meet these guys down in New York City. So this is 1980, and I went down there and helped reform them, took them into rehearsals, showed them around what was going on. Then we did a lot of casinos kind of things to get things going. We did a couple of commercial dates, but I said, yeah, let's go to the clubs up there. You know?
Yeah, you were more on the show circuit.
More
then,
on the show
point.
Circuit.
Yeah.
It was fun to do all that, you know.
Yeah.
In the upper state New York.
So that was the first time you were in with a show in the channel, yeah?
Well, it was a show, yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I ever came in with a show.
Uh-huh.
And we were one of the guys there who's been there since day one and played there, the Count, Viglione.
Joe Viglione, yeah.
I'll always remember him playing with Amanda, our daughter, and DC and stuff from Spanky and Our Gang, because Spanky was playing there with her.
With the Mums and Papas,
they
right?
played the video games, and Pac-Man and Pac-Woman, and they were into that, and they could hear the ding, 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 while I'm doing sound check. What's this? And it's them guys in the
playing
the arcade. But we had fun in there.
Yeah.
It was all different society that come in there. Some nights, not just the Mamas and Papas, but we had jazz in there, we had sit-down shows.
Yeah, it was a surprising mix, and it was always well-booked. Even the new music nights were always interesting. I mean, you know, the local band scene, which we encouraged.
Definitely.
God knows how much. I mean, four bands a night, five bands some nights.
Some nights even more, because you got Brian Washburn and booking stuff from his stuff.
More people on the stage than in the audience.
There was at one point, especially giving tickets out. But they were having fun. And a lot of groups that could play in there, like, there were groups that were made up from Berkeley that came through that didn't know anything to do with live.
Well, I think a lot of it that was kind of cool was that they wanted to play that big stage.
Exactly.
They wanted to play on a real sound system. They wanted to have stage monitors. They wanted to kind of it was a great place to get a workout in something that wasn't a little pokey club over in Cambridge, you know.
It's true.
You felt like you were on a big stage, you had real lights. And
that's why they wanted to come.
Yeah.
And have fun every night. And then, there's, the groups that were a bit wild in their own right, like Butthole Surfers.
Yeah, I remember that, I think.
Gibby.
Yeah.
Well, they have a show where they had this giant screen that we had to rent, for, and also a movie projector that cost a fortune to rent, because they had these real big films, and they had got them all from the University of Texas operations.
Yeah.
Really weird stuff.
Oh, yeah. I remember some
really
of that stuff.
Really weird stuff, like a guy going, and then at the end of the day, he became a woman.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, these guys did dramatic theatre. And the theatre was interesting because of one thing. Gibby started playing away, and this little girl came on in a Japanese sumo setup. She came on, did a dance in, then took a cup and peed in it and drank it.
Oh, nice.
Very nice. But after that, Gibby took lighter fluid out.
Probably tasted like the beer in the channel.
Oh, the beer were better than that. Then he put lighter fluid on the damn cymbal, lit the lighter fluid, hit the cymbal with a stick, and flames are everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I rushed on stage, took that bugger right out the back door, amplifier, guitar and all. Yeah. Get out of there. You're not setting fire to this club.
Yeah.
I was so happy that we'd already taken down that rest of that roof.
And we didn't have smoke detectors.
Oh, no.
Or a sprinkler system.
No, we did have sprinklers.
Do we have sprinklers back there?
We had sprinklers in there. That's the thing that was cool. I was worried that the sprinklers were going to go off and drown everybody because there were so many.
My favourite story he used to tell me was when we got a high tide, the water would come up from the Four Points Channel up and under the stage.
Yeah.
And you told me, I remember you telling me all about the Mercury retrograde was when it would happen.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'd get buzzes in the sound system.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the water that was in everything.
Oh, yeah.
I never forget you telling me that and going through all that with you. So I was always checking the tides in the Mercury retrograde.
Well, it was fun. There was always something going on.
Yeah.
24/7 there, really. I mean, when you looked at, one thing that we have to also remember is that any of you people out there remember the guy who used to pick up all the trash outside in the day called Al.
Al
was a great guy. Al actually saved someone's life, and that was Costa.
Costa was the guy. Costa and his wife used to clean the club.
Clean the club
every night, and Costa didn't speak English. He'd come from Greece.
Yeah, and his little daughter.
And they'd bring his little daughter in there, who was probably 8 or 9 at the time, and she'd be in there when Dinky and I had been in the morning cleaning, and that was Maria Menounos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she turned into... Anyway, the wonderful stuff from her, but the thing that was really cool about Al is that one day, because he used to go in there and then go and ask Jack for a pint or something, and he'd go in there and get his beer.
Yeah, I would always give him a drink when he was cleaning and give him something for doing stuff,
Anyway, he came into looking for a drink and he found Costa was in some diabetic thing going
on. Oh, yeah.
And he actually saved his life because he made Costa eat this, because he was in a bad way, and that was the only time that I knew that Costa was on his own.
Right.
Because usually his wife was with him.
Or Maria,
Yeah, Maria would come and make sure he was safe and stuff.
Yeah, Costa's was good. And I remember Al always being there. Oh. He was always out tagging up the parking lot.
He was always funny, but he was always good at what he did.
Well, there were always characters around down there. That was an interesting part of Boston, that at the time the artist lofts were just starting to get built out across the street. Oh. And there was nothing really down there. There was no seaport. There was none of that going on.
No, one end of the place there was Moles of the Diner.
Right, and next door we were on Necco Place, weren't we?
Yeah.
Next door, and that had been the old Necco candy factory way back, before it moved out to Revere or wherever.
Yeah, they moved
somewhere up north.
Further over towards Cambridge, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere like that.
Yeah, it was a good... And the channel itself had quite a history, the Four Points.
Oh, the Four Points channel. I mean, you could get people coming in there from all over the country. In fact, people used to come in from different parts of the world for certain things.
Yeah.
Because they'd heard so much about it. I remember you running over to Dingwalls in England, and you had, we had a situation where you come over and bring the ideas of what was going on
there. Yeah, we were trying to start a band exchange.
That was it. That was the thing.
Peter Gross had become a friend of mine who ran Dingwalls in Camden.
Yeah.
And we were trying to start a swap where we'd send local bands to London and bring London bands to the Channel.
Well, you know, after all this, the bands that really kept going and still going to this day, Barons Whitfield, for instance, he goes over to Germany every year now for his festival times. They love him over there.
Oh yeah,
they love what's going on with him.
The local scene
makes his money now. He's over there. But he used to come to the Channel and rip it up. It was fantastic when he was.
I remember Barons being in there with the Replacements.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That was the night you went after Paul Westerberg for pouring beer in your monitors.
Yeah, something like that. I went after a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
I've been there doing that a bunch of times.
And the night after, they played the Ritz and Westerberg fell off the stage.
Oh.
And broke his leg.
Oh dear.
But I remember the night you went after him in the middle of the show.
I went after a few hours over the time period.
Oh, yeah, of course.
If they start being dicks on stage, they were going to get it.
Yeah, was your gear.
I'd go right inside of the monitor guy and turn him off. Right. Get out, come on.
Good stuff.
And the door out the back was easy to get right off stage into the door. Right
well,
out.
It was always interesting, wasn't it? It was an easy load in because we'd no stairs there, so people liked coming in.
Yeah.
You walk right in that back door and up onto the stage.
Yeah.
And I know we'd done the stage a couple of times. But it was a good setup. It was just the low ceiling was always kind of tough for
until
lighting.
Until we got rid of it.
Yeah, but then we had Dave Bernhardt, right, who was a lighting guy.
Yeah.
Legendary lighting guy in Boston.
Great.
He ended up at the House of Blues, I think, before he died. He worked at the House of Blues for years.
Well, he was doing also something for the town, city of Boston, upstairs of the... The Prudential Building.
Yeah.
Upstairs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He was doing that kind of stuff.
He was one of the guys who could create a light show out of nothing.
Oh, beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
First time I met him was when I was going out with Jay Giles.
Uh-huh.
He was the Jay Giles' lighting guy, and DB and I were hit it off. We just couldn't believe how well the combination worked.
Right.
Him on lights, me on sound, and we had our little booth out in the audience.
Yeah. We had a lot of good engineers and good tech guys came through the Channel.
Wonderful stuff.
Guys that you trained and choose.
Yeah, well, from Timmy Hines, who's not here with us anymore.
Right.
Tim Miller.
Yeah.
Tim
Miller
went.
Where did Tim Miller go?
Tim Miller went to NSYNC.
Right.
And Britney Spears.
New kids
on the block.
Of course,
yeah.
That's where I got him involved.
David Wendling, who'd work with you. Dave went with Dr. John and the Gypsy Kings and the Everlys.
And now he's running the Berkeley stuff.
He runs the Berkeley production.
And he's
showing
our people how it really is, and so the Berkeley kids can learn from somebody.
Dave taught me stuff in the Channel. I remember going through the. You were talking about analog earlier versus digital.
Oh,
and I remember being amazed to find out how you were mixing the four bands or five bands new music nights with the paper overlays on the console. So you do the sound check and put a piece of paper over all the knobs.
Well, we didn't learn marker.
And then mark them all.
Like a lot of them was to mark one pencil, or, you know.
Yeah, you'd mark what time o'clock each dial was set at for that band when it was mixed, and then tear it off and then put the next one on.
I gave him a piece of paper with all the knobs on it, so all they had to do is adjust it and write it down on it, because it was already printed out.
I remember them, and I remember seeing the overlays for the boards.
But it's the only way to go.
Yeah.
I mean, because
well, you're doing four or five bands a night. And you'd sound check them in reverse order.
We'd make them come in at 4 o'clock
in
the afternoon, unless there were 1 o'clock shows and 2 o'clock shows or 3 o'clock shows, because we had a lot of those over the time.
And you'd sound check everybody in reverse order and then start with the first one and peel them back.
It's like a store.
Yeah.
You've got every kind of piece of equipment you could ever imagine. Somebody would come through either with a big frame for their metal band that had all the drums on there, unbelievable.
Yeah, they come in with set cards and all kinds of stuff. Yeah,
we built a platform for a drum riser, yeah. And some of them couldn't even get on that drum riser. Right. They were so big, the yeah. amount of cymbals. I'm saying, are you going to play every one of them?
That's right. They come with those double drum kits and everything
then
else.
Then you get a Charlie yeah. Watts. You'd come in there with a snare and a hat, and that was it. Not really, yeah. There was a tom. And a
still note. Gets ridiculous. I remember a show about 5 years ago, as I was in the Melody Tent doing production, and I had a guy come in, I won't mention his name, but he was an opening act, and he was a national act, and he came in and he set 9 guitars up on the stage.
What?
And his set list came up, and he was only doing 7 songs. I said, "How are you doing? What are you doing 7 songs? What do you need 9 guitars for?" You're playing 2 at once.
Sometimes
he
did.
And he was all over it.
I mean, sometimes he had a stand with a guitar on it, and then another stand with another guitar, and they walked to one and walked to. This is a metal band would do that.
Yeah, yeah. They'd pick and choose as they go.
Yeah, exactly. Pick it. Well, I want a 6 string now, but I'll do a 12 string here.
The production stuff was always good in there, though. That's, I remember the sound checks, and it did take a long time. And you were talking about digital again. That's the only plus on the digital side was now you...
Oh, it's easy to
now
work.
Now you just punch them in the board and record it, yeah. and everything right. flies back to position.
But the quality of an analogue recording or an analogue show was phenomenal.
Agreed. Well, I think it's the difference between record players and CD players. It's I hear it, I know the physicality of it, and I think a lot of times it's the difference between LED lights and... And regular light bulbs, you know, there's a difference.
They're always too bright. You could never really steer them correctly.
There's something cold about it, you know.
Yeah, and it's
yeah.
cold.
Yeah.
Anything to do with that digital is computer-based. It's one and zeros. The bottom line is humans love to hear and feel the music, not be distorted in the brain like you have to do. If you put a headset on today... You get MP3s mainly, and you put the MP3s mainly, and the brain has to change that compression that MP3s got to release the signal into your brain so that you can hear everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's It's terrible.
Yeah, you're not using the physical.
You're not feeling good.
Right.
You know, I mean, even in heavy metal when it was so, or hardcore when it's so loud, you still felt good with analog. As soon as you put the digital on, Your neck's
to my neck. Interesting.
It's irritant.
Yeah.
And even through it could be analog speakers you're playing it through.
Yeah.
It still don't make any difference. It's digital source.
Yeah. So it's got a different end to it.
That's why I'm always into the put the vinyl on and then you'll feel the music.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a big difference.
It makes a real big difference. But anyway, we were talking about...
Just to me, the point where I'm buying my record collection again, which is crazy.
I got all my... people are after my Northern Soul record collection. I used to play in all the clubs in England. I've still got 45s.
Wow. And that stuff has become, huge. They're doing a lot of that again in England, you know. They're doing the all-night raves again with Northern Soul.
They were fun because it's not alcohol. It was more for the teens, and when you're raving like that, of course there's other things involved, but you don't need to.
Well, they started going out to meet people. It was social. And I think that's what's missing a lot now, and that's where the Channel really did have a good vibe.
The Channel had the best.
As a venue, because I think a lot of times now people are out to buy a ticket to go see a specific...
Exactly.
Act in those days, you used to go to the club because that was the club.
Yeah.
And you would count on them to put some decent music on.
Exactly.
And there was a difference in how that scene evolved. The audience was part of the club scene. I mean, going to clubs not knowing who was playing, or festivals just to suss it out, you know.
Teen clubs and stuff. We based everything on. I mean, I not only in '65, I already. Went to the Mojo, I was saying.
Well, you were DJing, right?
I was DJing, and we had our own clubs, the Pendulum Club, rented a church hall in England, mm-hmm. in Rotherham, and did that. And then we got out of control there because there was too many people. So we moved over to this thing that we call Lemon B Jefferson Club near the Millmore Football Ground.
Uh-huh.
And we got busted by the cops about three shows in because there was 500 people more than the building could hold.
Illegal, yeah.
Because the kids were coming out to have fun.
Yeah. And dance. Yeah.
Meet girls. Girls were there to meet the boys. Whatever. It was just a really fun place. We did add a few groups in there, like Peter Frampton, The Herd.
Right, but back then they'd be out mainly to promote their
record
sales, right? That's what changed. It was they were special guests, and you get to see a band live.
Exactly. The all-nighters, like I said at the Mojo, the all-nighters were open again after we'd done a regular night of records till 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
Close the club and open up again all night. We had right. lines outside working all night. And then we'd have the groups that were coming down from Newcastle, The Who would pop in.
They'd have played a little gig somewhere. I know I read The Small Faces came in there and played.
Made some good money.
Yeah.
You know, Rod Stewart, I'll always remember Rod. Rod coming in with a steam packet. He couldn't believe the way that these girls were looking, so he decided to work in the cloakroom.
Yeah, I've heard that.
He
used to take the money at the door in Manchester at the Twisted Wheel.
Yeah. He loved it because he was looking at all the girls.
Yeah.
And funny stuff, but it was really cool to see that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's how it was evolving. That's how the business was growing.
But the channel, when they were doing that, they would in the afternoons, we'd have them do special things.
Yeah.
You know, especially the metal acts in the afternoon, you know, they loved all that stuff.
I remember we used to do the lunchtime shows with BCN or the radio stations. We'd do a free hot dog and a dollar beer.
Now that was it.
And the bands, you know, I think Peter used to say to me, you know what's in a hot dog, now imagine what's in a free one.
I can see Peter saying that stuff, and he'd have a big smile on his face.
Absolutely. There was a lot of fun stuff that we were pulling off.
I mean, all the stuff we do to do with the lunchtime shows, that was just special.
Yeah.
You know, and bringing in, and also we're bringing in a lot of MCs that came in at night.
Well, yeah, we always had guest DJs, didn't we, that were part of the scene there and tried to fit them to the tone of the show.
Exactly.
So Kevin, the Black Star Liner, was a reggae expert anyway.
Well, Kevin had his own radio show on Emerson or whatever.
Right.
And he'd bring each one of these guys and girls that came from Jamaica or from Africa to this radio show and promote on through the radio show the playing at the channel or.
Well, the channel was really the only club that was receptive to a lot of that.
Well, for that kind of stuff, I mean, everything to do with the reggae, to do with
world beat music, punk,
King Sunny Our Day, you know, Retablo, Rochelle, all those.
I think anything that was considered alternative in the early 80s. The established clubs were sort of leaving alone and doing a lot of the local development with the Cars Until Tuesday and things like that.
But
the club
come
was
over there. You'd get such good fun.
The channel would book a lot of the stuff that had been on the college circuits for sure. But World Beat and the DJs that came in from BCN, Carmelita and Bradley J,
Tammy Heidi, Shred,
Lisa Traxler.
Carter. Mark Parento.
Oh, yeah, Mark would show up once in a while for shows.
And then the lunchtime show with Tank and stuff.
And Tank,
and
guys, they'd come over and have some fun with us.
Turkey drop once in a while, I remember. It was fun.
And then we did, I remember doing the, you remember doing a benefit for Mario from the Hell's Angels
in
Salem? That was a fun night.
That was a good one. And then we'd do Halloween nights for the ladies and stuff where Bonnie Raitt played.
I remember doing one for Laurie Cabot.
And
the Salem Witches.
Oh, yeah. They were special nights.
Yeah.
Or even for the Centurion Club, the police.
Yep.
They'd call, come in and they'd have people like Michael Messina playing it.
Good Lord. Yeah.
And I would start laughing.
Oh, yeah.
It's
good stuff. Well, we're going to get into more and more of this, and hopefully Tim will prompt us along, and we're going to get a little bit specific as we do more of these podcasts, we hope. We're going to try to, I think we'll try and theme them a little bit, I think, so we'll go through the list that you've so lovingly compiled of everybody who played there, and we'll kind of dissect it into genres or
Well, I started doing years metal and hardcore.
Yeah, years and dates, and we'll get a little more specific and remember some shows. Remember some stuff.
We talked about a couple right now, but there's so many good shows.
Yeah.
In fact, in 1987, there must be hundreds of shows that were just metal.
So good. So join us again next time, and we'll have two pints in the corner.
We will for sure.
Good stuff.